KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
In practical terms, it is oftentimes really just an audition.
An audition that you are paying money for.
Exactly.
If you're an aspiring actor, you may have paid to attend casting workshops that were supposed to be educational, but really just offered very quick auditions for very minor roles. The casting workshop business has made millions of dollars, but it turns out that paying for an audition is illegal. Reporter Gary Baum talks about his investigation that recently led to the filing of criminal charges. And veteran casting director Billy DeMota explains his long-standing opposition to these pay-to-play auditions. But first on the News Banter, Paramount's Top Job finally opens up. Any takers? And stay tuned for a bonus banter we'll talk about last night. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, so it took a long time. Paramount Pictures has not distinguished itself in recent years, although it does have a couple of films in Oscar contention. So it's not like they disappeared off the earth, but they are firmly in last place this year. They lost, I don't know, $450 million in the past year. And finally, Viacom, which has gone through major upheaval over the past year or two, finally had the exit of Brad Gray as chairman of the studio is a thing, a reality. And, you know, I have to say, in this community, some people were amazed that given the studio's performance, he held on as long as he did.
Right. 12 years at a studio and that type of high-pressure job is a lot. And I think some of the longevity was due to the overall chaos at the Viacom parent company and the decline of Sumner Redstone and some of the other pressing issues that they have had elsewhere. But he's also the consummate Hollywood insider. He was a very successful talent manager, worked with Brad Pitt before this, and has been a survivor. And I'm sure he'll do something interesting after this.
What we're looking at is sort of a cultural thing. You know, Philippe Domon was the CEO of Viacom, the parent company. And to many people nowadays, these jobs of running studios are not about having a tremendous vision that you really want to bring and feeling the zeitgeist and greenlighting these movies. It's about managing up, you know. And as long as Brad Gray stayed in the graces of Philippe Domon, whose goal was to manage from quarter to quarter and make the numbers look as good as possible, even if the reality was less good, you know, then longevity was assured. And I think that managing up has become, in some cases, more important for these guys who run studios than the job that they are doing. And that takes its toll. You start to see the movie business at this point. I feel, you know, it's kind of at a bit of an ebb in terms of the studios. They're making giant tent poles. They don't make that much else. Very few of them are actually good at making the giant tent poles. And I think it's become a gradual creep of studio chiefs who are basically suits managing up.
Yeah, if you look at the way that Paramount was managed, they weren't releasing a lot of films, which can juice the numbers for a year. And I think that was a big priority for them. But they weren't creating these franchises that can move on to the next level. If you're just doing another Star Trek, you're not making enough movies to have that hit that generates a franchise. And they didn't have the investment from the parent company to really invest in the top tier talent that can do that stuff. I think it's an example of how you're seeing the movie business bifurcate into a have and have not system. There are the major players like Disney and Comcast with Universal and Fox and Warner Brothers to a certain extent. And then you have these studios that are just kind of lagging behind Sony and Paramount, where they don't have the wherewithal to really go full steam into it. And they don't have the long view. And they don't have that brand management where they can really compete on this level.
And they don't have the intellectual property that a place like certainly Disney, you know, is by far the first among all of them. You could say they bought it when they bought Lucasfilm, when they bought Marvel. But guess what? They bought it. And now they have it. And they have a ton of material, which is lacking at these other places. So it feels to me that as we move forward, as the movie business gets increasingly challenged, as there's a lot of other options, even more so than before in terms of entertainment, you know, in terms of streaming and what you want on demand, I think the studio herd is going to thin.
I think so. And it'll be interesting to see how Paramount goes about replacing Brad Grey. If they go with another seasoned guy in his 50s or 60s, like Jim Giannopoulos, who ran Fox, or like someone like Mary Parent, who is a big producer and is currently at Legendary, or if they do something new and maybe hire someone who is an up-and-comer who may try to reinvent things or even go a different way and hire a full-on brand manager type who is not even really a creative person at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the seasoned players will be leery because they can't figure out who's in charge and how much they say they want to make movies based on their brands being things like Nickelodeon, you know, SpongeBob or MTV. Don't ask me what that is. Several of these places that are supposed brands, these labels that are based on their channels, don't have a lot of stuff to work with either, but they're going to try to find stuff, make it, and then turn it into movies. That's the long-term plan. So who's in charge of what those movies are? I think there's going to be a lot of leeriness. And while I'm on this topic, I will use Comedy Central, which is one of the Viacom channels that has lost a lot of talent, to turn to Stephen Colbert, who is, as everyone must know if they care about this industry, now at CBS. And, you know, for a long time, it was like, Stephen Colbert, it's just not working. It's not working. This persona doesn't suit him. And I think largely due to our current president, Donald Trump, who is the fountain of never-ending material, Stephen Colbert is on fire.
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, for the past 3 weeks, he has beaten Jimmy Fallon, and by increasing margins each week. A lot of people have said that Colbert has seemed revitalized and energetic, and the kind of comedy, which is this biting, satirical but topical political humor, is really benefiting from the political climate right now. Whereas Fallon, who has been the longtime leader in the space, is known much more as a nice guy, fun stunts, games, not necessarily the sharpest political commentator.
Fallon is still ahead slight in terms of adults, 18 to 49, the most desirable demographic. But we'll see how long that lasts. You know, I agree. Fallon has tried to edge a little bit into the political material, but it's not really what he does. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In La La Land, Emma Stone plays aspiring actress Mia, who finds herself demoralized as she faces one failed audition after another.
Two options. You either follow my rules or follow my rules. Capiche?
Thank you.
I can do it a different way.
No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
What the movie doesn't show is something that has gone on for years in the real La La Land. Aspiring actors like Mia scraping together $50 or so to get a quick audition for a minor role in a film or TV show. It might be a network show like Criminal Minds or Big Bang Theory, and with luck, you might get one line. Paying to audition is illegal. Last year, my colleague Gary Baum of The Hollywood Reporter conducted an investigation into this practice, which has taken root in sessions known as casting workshops.
A casting workshop is ostensibly an educational experience put on by a casting director, an associate, where an actor can learn how to audition better. In practical terms, it is oftentimes really just an audition.
An audition that you are paying money for.
Exactly.
And at $50 a pop, if you're going a couple of times a month,
you know, it adds up, $1,000, $1,500 a year. If your main gig is being a barista at Starbucks, that's a lot of money.
Now, it might seem sensible to say if you don't have the money, simply don't go to the workshops. But
it had become so commonplace that a struggling actor found that this was really the benchmark, the cornerstone of how you became an actor, really how you got those initial gigs in order to get your SAG membership. It became part of the system. It became central to the system so that there really was no way to maneuver other than to engage with this problem.
Earlier this month, Los Angeles City Attorney Mike Feuer filed criminal charges for the first time ever against this practice, naming 25 people involved in running five alleged pay-to-play workshops.
It's unlawful to charge anyone, any performer, for an audition, even if that supposed activity is disguised as some educational workshop.
We reached out to several of those facing charges, but none responded to our requests for comment. We did see an email sent to clients by one of the casting workshop operators charged by the city attorney. It said its practices are legal and that actors should be free to spend their money as they see fit. Today we're talking to reporter Gary Baum and to casting director Billy DeModa, who explains why he has long been opposed to pay-to-play casting workshops.
The impetus was because I was serving on the board of directors of the Casting Society of America. And one night in the mid-late 90s, we talked about the problem of casting directors charging for these workshops. And there were certain rules that we had in place in our bylaws that were continued to be violated. And one casting director literally raised her hand and said, well, why don't we just get rid of the guidelines and then none of our members will get in trouble?
Okay.
And I said, literally on the record, I said, why don't we get rid of all the red lights in Los Angeles and nobody will get a ticket for going through a stop sign? So the fact is they literally threw all the rules out in the mid, I think, 1996. And so I started my efforts to make people aware of these things called casting director workshops and what they really were and what their real intent and purpose was.
I imagine this is very divisive within that organization because people are making money from doing it.
It's very divisive. It's a multi-million dollar industry. Every dollar paid by actors, by the way.
This cost burden that used to be absorbed by producers, by studios and networks, has been pushed down to actors. And so now actors are absorbing that because, for the most part, casting directors and their associates and assistants are not paid very much. And so they have now created a system where they are now looking for talent on nights and getting paid $50 per person to read for 2 or 3 minutes. To do this.
It's like more expensive than therapy.
Yeah. I mean, this is the system that's been created. And so it's an atomized way of looking at doing business in Hollywood.
So did you go to one of these workshops?
I did. I attended several workshops. Some people invited me in. You know, the casting workshops can, in theory, be done correctly. Gary Zuckerbrod, who's a former CSA, Casting Society of America head, invited me into one of his classes at a place called ITA. And he showed me an exemplary example.
Where he was actually teaching people something.
Where he was teaching people. And he is an advocate of workshops. And I will say that no matter the quality of education at any workshop that I attended, every single actor that was there for one reason only. And that was to get a job, to develop a relationship specifically to advance their career.
No one said, yeah, I'm here to learn how to audition.
No, nobody was there to do that. And they were specifically there to meet a Gary Zuckerbrod or to meet a Scott David, who at the time was casting Criminal Minds or whoever it might be.
I think that casting directors, by and large, have created this sort of disconnect with reality in the sense that their casting community wants to continue to believe that these are education.
They're telling themselves that.
Probably, exactly. Mm-hmm. When probably 95% of them are simply the one-on-one reading with a casting director. You know, the city attorney has filed charges. I'm not sure what they found, but I don't think they would have filed charges if there were real classes going on. And I think that that's the point. And the teachers in this town, casting directors who are teachers saying, uh-oh, we have to watch out, where next? Well, that's not the case because the city attorney was not looking to shut down real educational events. They were looking to stop the pay-to-play.
So there were indictments. This was the first time since this law was enacted in 2009 that anybody got charged. And what sort of people were they? Because, you know, I noticed in your coverage, you know, there were really people who have serious pipelines to major television shows. Are they the sort of people that got charged? Or was it the people who were that they don't really have any pull at all? Because that is what one would expect a little bit, like, let's get for the weakest.
It was a mix. It was some small players. It was some people involved in some of the biggest network television shows. And we're going to see how this stuff plays out, whether or not the city attorney is going to be able to make these charges stick. In the following days, a couple of these workshop companies closed pretty much immediately. Some of the other workshop firms have basically emptied up their calendar slate of classes. There had already been sort of a retraction, a retrenchment on this issue over the past year since I published my initial investigation. As the sort of fallout grew, and particularly since the city attorney's investigation became public last summer,
people got out while the getting was good.
People started getting out while the getting was good. It became known that the city attorney's investigators were asking questions.
They sent undercover people in to take the classes?
They sent an undercover actor in to take classes, and then they corroborated with other information.
He walked out, or she, and said, I learned nothing, and I was charged money, and I had 2 minutes.
I don't think we know yet exactly.
We don't know yet. Because
that's in their files.
Correct. We'll probably find out if enough happens during trial or through the court proceedings.
Do you expect a trial? I mean, they could plead to something, right? Misdemeanor something. I don't know what the penalties are.
I don't know. I mean, we haven't seen how it would work out. It really is unprecedented. There are a number of different individuals. They could go different directions depending on their own interests. I think that the city attorney wants to make a statement here.
They might make an example of someone.
Right. They probably wanted something to stick.
Okay. So there was a comment on your story about the charges being filed, which appears to be someone who took one of these workshops and said, an actor part of me says good for the crackdown. Part of me says now what? Meaning because workshops replaced generals, meaning, you know, these kind of
general interviews
calls.
With
them. Yeah. Right. I'm paraphrasing a little here. Most agents won't take you unless you have a few co-stars on your resume, but you can't get them without knowing a casting director. What's left for the actor to get a leg up?
You know, it's the same thing that happened before workshops. Hard work, determination, networking in ways that don't mean paying your way in. Solid actors with good representation find work.
This goes on. Most agents and managers require that you attend workshops and will demean you or even drop you, some have said, if you're not willing to do these things. And they see it as the actor's cost of doing business.
We might be hitting an inflection point where that expectation might not be there. There was an economic expectation that you would take these classes, which, if the city attorney is correct, oftentimes is illegal. And it was predatory. And if they're removed, then Hollywood will go on. Hollywood will recalibrate itself. The fact is that Hollywood needs to still cast those co-star roles. It needs to still find fresh talent. You know, it should be said that it's always been tough to make it as an actor. It's always been a statistical challenge. But it is far more so now in 2017 than it would have been in 1997 or 1977 or 1957, there are just more people in off the turnip truck than there used to be. So for a role that used to get maybe 50 or 100 or 150 people, now easily gets 3,000 people. And it becomes nearly impossible for just a random three-line role to find somebody. It's a needle in a haystack thing, and it creates all sorts of incentives and disincentives to create what's really apparent for casting directors, which is the tyranny of acquaintanceship. You meet somebody, you kind of know somebody. Are they good? No, they're good enough. You kind of know them. You met them at an acting workshop. You kind of want to do them a solid. I mean, it's two lines. How much can this is? They're not the star. You kind of know them. You put them in. You work them in.
But what that does, though, I think, changes the fabric of the casting in network TV in that those are the actors that wind up getting the co-star roles and the guest star roles. Now, even though it's just a line or two, you know, the test results are in, doctor, or would you like more coffee? You know, when the best actors are not considered for the roles, then I think the quality of casting overall tends to suffer. And I think we see it sometimes in network TV, but you know, that's just an opinion more than anything else, I think.
Casting director Billy DeModa and Gary Baum, senior writer for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. My pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, a bonus post-Oscars banter with The Hollywood Reporter's awards analyst. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. And now a little extra banter, and of course, we have to talk about last night. For that, I'm joined by Scott Feinberg, awards analyst at The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Scott, and oh my God.
Yeah, that's about all we can say right now. I mean, I know we'll say more, but I'm still processing it. I don't know about you.
All right, we're just going to play a little snippet for the people who care about movies and did somehow not see or hear this. This is the story
right.
That unfortunately is the dominant story of the Oscars.
We lost, by the way, but, you know.
Guys, I'm sorry. No, there's a mistake.
Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won. This is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
So I'm just going to briefly say, I mean, I don't want to go too into whose fault it is. You know, the Pricewaterhouse has issued an apology. Clearly, there was a duplicate envelope. Clearly, that ended up in Warren Beatty's hand. I will say, I don't think this was Warren Beatty's fault or Faye Dunaway's fault at all.
I'm going to disagree with you about that, because what happened with the envelopes is they have on both sides of the stage the same envelope for each category, so that if one is misplaced or somebody decides right. to say the wrong name, you know, if somebody ever wanted to just say their friend's name, they are ready to spring into action. So the first, there were three things that went wrong here. Number one, somebody at PricewaterhouseCooper, who at that point had only like three envelopes left to get correct, gave the wrong envelope to whoever gave it to Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. But the second mistake was that when Warren Beatty opened the envelope and saw the name Emma Stone, who's clearly not the sole producer of La La Land, rather than, you know, it would have been awkward, but rather than seeking clarification, he passed it along to Faye Dunaway and maybe he was meaning to run it by her.
Yes,
but
I think that's clear from the tape. He looks at the envelope. He even looks again into the envelope looking for another card.
Right.
She then starts to kind of bug him.
She wants to get going. It's getting awkward.
She wants to get going, and he tries to show it to her, and she instantly—
She just says it. Mm-hmm. So that was both of them, I think, could have handled that better. And then the third mistake is that the reason PricewaterhouseCooper has accountants right off the stage is so, again, that if anything goes wrong— they are able to spring right into action.
I agree with you. They should
and
have instantly.
This is terrible because they took so long that the entire La La Land principal cast and crew gets up all the way to the stage.
Yes.
Two people give full acceptance speeches and a third was getting started before they intervened. That's unacceptable.
That is
it
unacceptable.
Humiliated those people and it took so much away from what was a unbelievable. It would have been a historic upset if it had just been announced cleanly for Moonlight.
Yes.
You know, that would have been the thing we were talking about anyway. But instead, neither of them, you know, got what they deserved.
Well, I will say, you know, having been on live television, mm-hmm. as I know you have, mm-hmm. live television is a lot of pressure, even if you're a movie star mm-hmm. with millions of people around the world watching. So yes, in an ideal world, Warren Beatty would have said, there's a problem. Mm-hmm. I think he hesitated and she jumped in. And so I'd say the people who didn't intervene faster are the ones who gave him the wrong envelope and then did not say, there's a mistake and somehow spring into action. That's the part that I don't understand. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it is a shame, really, because it was an upset, as you say. I think you predicted earlier that this was going to be almost a lock for La La Land.
Quite possibly the biggest Best Picture upset in the history of the Oscars. There are people that are going to obviously cite Crash versus Brokeback Mountain. There are going to be people that talk about Shakespeare in Love versus Saving Private Ryan. But
Not the same.
They didn't have 14 nominations and had won every major predictive award that there is, save for the SAG Ensemble Award, which we thought there were extenuating circumstances, since La La Land isn't really an ensemble. It's a two-hander. And furthermore, in the 22 years in which the three big guilds that we pay attention to, the Screen Actors Guild, the Producers Guild, and Directors Guild, have coexisted, only one other time with Braveheart, 21 years ago, has a movie not won any of their top awards and still won the Best Picture Oscar. So this is basically, and I don't say this just to let myself off the hook, but I'm telling you, like, there is no way that you could have justified predicting Moonlight. Now, the only thing that I think explains it is that they have a preferential ballot that they've been using since they expanded the Best Picture category in 2009, going into 2010. And what I think that does is, it weighs it so that it's not only the movie that you don't just have one line where you say, this is my Best Picture. You have five lines and you say, well, this is my first choice. This is my second choice. And then what they do is it's not only about which movie got the most number ones, because that might not even be a majority.
The most number two votes,
most at the top. And I think what we found, even with our Brutally Honest Ballots thing that we were running here at the Hollywood Reporter, was that La La Land was a love-hate movie, whereas Moonlight, at least everybody always respected it. They maybe didn't put it at one, but it was at two or three.
And some did put it at one. And, you know, it's a first in many respects, right? It's probably the lowest budget movie ever to win an Oscar, right?
When you account for inflation, yes.
It is the first African-American dominated themed movie to win an Oscar.
Gay theme. I mean, you could argue Midnight Cowboy, but yes.
And I have to say, Midnight Cowboy sort of, not really.
Not like this.
And I have to say, I do think maybe as the Trump administration has progressed, the desire to recognize that movie may have increased among voters.
I think so. And I think, you know, it was really a perfect storm. This was also on the heels of these 2 years where the Academy got savaged for Oscar So White. It was, you know, as you say, sort of a middle finger to the Trump administration, as was the win for the Iranian movie in the foreign language category.
Although you hate to say that.
But I can tell you there was no way that movie was winning prior to the Muslim ban. Not a chance.
Not a chance, really.
And I mean, the guy won 5 years ago. It wasn't a particularly, it wasn't the most acclaimed movie of those five this year. So he's a terrific filmmaker. It's not to insult him. But the real world has had, and the Academy world has definitely impacted the results.
Now, despite all the talk about how political it would be, it was somewhat muted, I thought, and the ratings didn't go up, despite whatever curiosity people might have had or love of La La Land or Hidden Figures or any of the movies. I don't know what that means for the Academy.
I think, they really tried everything. I think they have, to start it out with a big musical number instead of a monologue or something right away. That was an interesting move. I really don't think they could have put on a better show up until the end. It was really going great. I think Jimmy Kimmel, would have been very well received up to that point. And then he kind of also didn't handle that especially well, I don't think. But, part of what we've always found is that the Oscar show ratings are much more related to the interest in the Best Picture nominees than to anything else. And so we could sit here and talk about how Jimmy Kimmel did or how how long the show went or how funny it was or all of that. But I think it really was up against a wall from the start, because the only movies that were nominated for Best Picture that anybody really saw were Hidden Figures and La La Land.
Yeah, and there was no blockbuster. We always go back to that Titanic year, and I'm sure the Academy misses that.
Absolutely.
So notably, both Amazon and Netflix picked up their first Oscars, so that was a first also. And I would just say, as we look back and wrap it all up, I did feel that even though there was not a Titanic or such a huge blockbuster, it was a heck of a year. I was at the Night Before party on Saturday night, and I talked to one of the producers of Manchester by the Sea, and I said, in a different year, you would have been the movie.
Yeah.
And this year, such an embarrassment of riches.
Absolutely. And I mean, what was nice, if we want to find a silver lining in the way it all played out on Sunday night, is that the directors of the three most revered movies of the award season, La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight, each took home an Oscar. You had Chazelle, the director of
Damien Chazelle
of La La Land, winning for Best Director, becoming the youngest ever winner of that. You had Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, winning as a producer of the Best Picture. And you had Kenneth Lonergan, the director and writer of Manchester by the Sea, winning for Best Original Screenplay. So at least in some ways, those and many of the other Best Picture nominees, including Arrival with sound editing, Hacksaw Ridge with sound mixing and film editing, there was a lot of love spread around. And I think that's fitting for a year, like you say, that had a lot to offer.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Ken.
That's Scott Feinberg, awards analyst at The Hollywood Reporter. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. Stay tuned. The world is coming up next.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.